Monster Man, episode 405. Giants again. Again? Part 2.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we'll be continuing our journey through Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're going to be looking specifically at the Giants section. Now, in our last episode, we covered 15 different subspecies of giant, but actually that's kind of cheating, because 13 of them were giants that had appeared in previous books and weren't all that different from how they'd originally been depicted. So we only focused on the two that were new to us, the desert and jungle giants, and that's also what we're going to do today. We're going to take the other two new giants from that section, and they're what we're going to cover. This is now the, I want to say, fourth time we've done giants on this show, not counting anything that is a giant but isn't in, like, the giant section of a book, like the Etin. So, you know, I don't feel any need to restate the premise. Oh, in giant-related news, I want to add something to last episode where I talked about the giant, wobbly from Fever Dreaming Marlinko. Because this giant is, like, summoned up and controlled by a labor union, it is, of course, wobbly in the sense that Wobblies was the nickname of the, the nickname of the industrial workers of the world, and I can't believe that I missed that. I did know about the Wobblies, and labor history in the U.S. is actually part of one of the curricula that I tutor, so I don't know how I missed that connection, and thank you to those who have pointed it out. Okay, let's look at these giants. First off, we have the giant, reef. Now, in the kind of continuity segment last episode, I said that this guy was blue, and he is not. He's just very pale white person skin colored, which means he's even more boring than he was in my memory visually. I gotta say, this is not a fantastic illustration. Again, there's nothing technically wrong with it, but there's something just kind of bland about it. It's as if, with all of these monsters, I feel a little bit like this artist, and I couldn't tell you which one it is, the name, but you can see the patterns in terms of how they draw. That this artist sort of feels like they draw these very right down the middle, kind of middle of the road illustrations. And I don't know if that's what they are personally choosing to do or whether that's what they feel fits the brief the best. But the result is that this giant just looks like a semi-nude man with a sword. He's wearing heavy metal kind of bracelets, which I don't think would help in swimming. He's wearing sort of seashell earrings, a seashell decorated sword belt with accompanying sword, and a loincloth. A fundoshi? Is that the word I'm looking for? Anyway, it's not a good look. You know, there are very few times when meeting a semi-nude man with a sword means your day is about to improve. You know, just, it tells you something about their priorities. However, when we actually get into the giant, reef entry, I think there's some good stuff here. The giants, reef are, well, I mean, they're giants and they live underwater, or they live underwater or in coastal zones, and they're quite interesting. They're sort of reclusive, but they do trade with other intelligent beings, so, like, they will go and they will gather pearls and coral and other valuable substances, you might, like, sunken treasure and just fish and other kind of the fruits of the sea that they go out catching in these big nets, and then they trade it with, like, you know, ships that pass by their islands and stuff like that. And, for that matter, they have these very elaborate residences on their islands that each generation of Giants, Reef will add to these sort of, they call them manors or mansions, and they get quite sort of lavish. So when they have children, they usually don't have very many, and the idea is that the eldest daughter inherits the mansion, and the sons go out into the world to, like, make their own way, find their own place. So whether they go and, like, set up their own mansion, but a lot of the time what it seems to happen is that they sort of compete to woo the daughter. The young women, you know, when their parents pass away, they become these kind of, like, wealthy property owners that have the manors on the islands. I quite like this, the idea of a kind of reef giant heiress who's got this mansion on an island, and therefore she has a bunch of potential spouses competing for her hand. I think that's a lot of fun. I like the idea of, you know, the adventurers maybe even getting hired by one of these suitors who wants some presents to give the heiress, or, you know, to foul up the other suitors in some way, make them look silly. I think that there's something there, right? All these different suitors competing for some Lady Giant's hand and estates. Or, you know, she could hire the adventurers to sort of like evaluate the different suitors. That'd be fun. They're also, you know, because of kind of the way that they work, if you need some piece of treasure and it like sank in a shipwreck, then it might have been picked up by a reef giant and be in one of these reef giant mansions, which means that essentially it's like a fancy... Like, what if an undersea dungeon wasn't all just, like, spiny fish that lie on the floor, but it actually was, like, fancy and elaborate? That'd be really cool, too. You could do a fun undersea dungeon with, like, all the different things that this reef giant has collected over the years, but they like to be left alone. I think there's actually a lot of potential in here, which is not what I was expecting. I was expecting a kind of filling-in-the-gaps monster where someone went, I guess we don't have an aqua giant yet. Because that is what the aqua versions of most monsters are like, unfortunately. So these guys actually have a lot of promise, although they definitely need a better illustration. This they have in common, with the needing a better illustration thing, maybe not the lot of promise thing, with the next giant on the list, the giant, comma, wood, parentheses, Vodkin, close parentheses. I do not get what the deal of the Vodkin is. So I think they're a Greyhawk creature. The earliest reference to them that I can find is in the 1990 Greyhawk Adventures supplement for the Monstrous Compendium. So they will have been compiled from there into this book. But it must be that they come from somewhere. They must have a point. Because here's the deal. First off, they look like... They're not that huge, right? These are another one of those... They're not just very tall people. They get up to about, you know, 9.5 to 10 feet tall. So that's about 3 meters for my metric listeners. So they're very tall. But they're not colossal. You know, they're not what you think of when you think of a giant. They're just very big people. And it says that they look like larger versions of wood elves, which, according to this illustration, they do not. They look like a wood elf if someone had coated their face in a layer of putty and tried to sculpt another version of the face on top of it using only their thumbs, and they didn't have any material to make the hair out of. They look like a wood elf wearing a novelty carnival head of some kind. They wear kind of like... What I think are meant to be like simple forest clothes, you know, kind of like caveman outfits almost, but instead look like these very neatly cut and manufactured leather aprons, and then like sand. They look ridiculous. They look like someone trying to persuade you that this is what Pyramid Head looks like when he takes his hat off. I do not know what is the thinking behind this visual design. And furthermore, I don't know what their deal is from a game perspective, because they're reclusive and they don't socialize with anybody who's not an elf. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't elves in D&D games, because of course there are, but I think it's very rare that you'll come across a party that is all elves. They also won't socialize with elves who don't have a good alignment. So all your neutral or evil elves are off the radar as well. So the Vodkin just keep to themselves, and they have very good tools for keeping to themselves, in addition to just being like stealthy and whatever. They can polymorph, so they can appear to be whatever they want. Although there's size restrictions, so they couldn't just pretend to be like a squirrel, that's too small. But they could pretend to be just like some elf passing by. So if you went looking for a wood giant and it didn't want to talk to you, it'd be pretty straightforward for it to avoid you. Sometimes it says they mingle with parties in order to trick them out of treasure, but I don't know why. What they don't appear to have belongings, so I don't know, you know, why they're stealing people's treasure, other than for the satisfaction of playing a mean-spirited joke on them, which is admittedly something that this game anticipated Dungeon Masters being very interested in. They don't really have a motivation to do anything that the player characters would either be interested in participating in or stopping. No one was out here saying, what if there were wood elves, but they were taller? I don't get it. And so, in the spirit of generosity, the only thing I can think of is that these are monsters who have been removed from their specific context. So they originally appeared in some kind of a scenario or something where their inclusion made sense. Even if that was just like, well, we're going to have an army of wood elves fight this army of bad guys. We need some kind of like slightly buffer heavy hitting units for the wood elf army. Honestly, I feel like that's kind of it. Maybe because, you know, like they fill the role that like tree men do in a Warhammer wood elf army, except the tree ants are bad in D&D, so you don't get this. I just don't know. When I look at a monster like this one, I always feel a little bit guilty, because on a purely mechanical level, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a giant, it hangs out in the woods. It can shoot arrows at you. It fight you with a sword. It's got polymorph, so it's not just a big sack of hit points. But the rest of it, the reason that it might be there or you might be there, you have to just completely make up, because it's not even the kind of creature that would be guarding a dungeon or something like that, or just encountered out like hunting and decide to eat you. Like, they're not going to eat people. They're not monsters. They're not monsters, he said on the Monster Podcast. But you know what I mean. So you kind of have to do all the work other than the mechanics, and there's not a lot here to be inspiring. Whereas, you know, they're not that different from the Giant Comma Reef, but just a few additional details on the Giant Comma Reef just make give you more things to hang the hat on. You know, maybe I'm being unfair to the Giant Comma Wood parentheses Vodkin close parentheses, but I'm not seeing where the fun part of them is. There do seem to be a number of monsters in this book created out of a kind of world-building impulse, which is to say, and many of these are from previous books. I'm not trying to say this is something that's unique to this book, but there does seem to be this trend of going like, well, there's a fire snake and a water snake and an air snake, so I guess there must be an earth snake. And then you create a monster whose only role is to be the fourth one in that set. So similarly, if you had that thing about, well, there must be a giant for every biome, like it's not enough that there are air giants, but there must also be cloud giants and fog giants. And, you know, if there's a hill giant, there must be a mountain giant, and if there's then desert giants and jungle giants, and there has to be a water giant, so I guess there needs to be a forest giant. And the role that this thing serves is it completes the set, but other than that, it doesn't really give you a lot to work with. And monster creation can be a really effective world-building tool. I don't want to deny that. So maybe these just say something about Greyhawk that I'm not attuned enough to Greyhawk to figure out. Who knows? Anyway, that's enough about giants. Now, coming up this week, we've got a new episode of Patron Deities for all Patreon backers at the $2 and higher level. And then, depending on how the scheduling works out, we may get a new listener request bonus episode, or we're going to take a look at some monsters that I have a very, like, a sentimental attachment to, kind of for no good reason, but we'll take a look at, you know, why monsters stick in the memory, even if the reason that you remember them isn't really the reason they were made. So please join me then as we talk about the Gibberling and the Gith. We'll also mention the Gif, but we did do a special episode on it, so I don't think we're going to really cover it. So the Gibberling and the Gith, next time on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.